This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
We got a lot to get through today. New stuff going on in the Nancy Guthrie and Alec Murtaugh case. And Bob Mott is with us to help break it all down. We'll start with Nancy. She was taken from her Tucson home 5 months ago, in case you've been living under a rock. 84 years old. Just in case. Just in case. Nancy who? 84 years old. Pulled out in the middle of the night by someone who showed up armed and masked on her own doorbell camera. 50,000 tips, $1 million in reward money. FBI and Pima County Sheriff running parallel investigations, although seemingly at odds a lot of the time. And nobody can name a single suspect. Meanwhile, notes claiming to be from the abductor say Nancy is dead at a completely separate person has been emailing TMZ claiming he has the whole case on a phone. But you need to give me a Bitcoin and I'll tell you where I'm hitting the phone, and the phone's a silver platter and la da 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 da. We're going to get into all of that today. Like I said, Bob Mott, defense attorney with us, Defense Diaries. You can get his podcast, YouTube, wherever you get podcasts. And of course, Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program. Start here. 5 months, 50,000 tips, more than $1 million in reward money. The FBI hasn't publicly named a single person of interest yet. A lot of people, Bob, are speculating. What's taking so long here? But let's take a look at it from an angle of prosecuting a case like this. You really got to make sure those T's are crossed and those I's are dotted, and not inversely the other way. Do you think that maybe they have some leads back somewhere, and they're making sure that it's going to stand up really good if you're going to get the person arrested and put him in a cell? Or are they just hitting a dead end? From your experience in the legal world, what's your thoughts?
Well, potentially, yes. I think they probably have some leads.
Yeah.
Whether or not they're strong enough to bring a case, because at this point it's a no-body case.
Yep.
You know, but look, we've seen the trend in the last couple of decades. No-body cases, you know, it used to be the old thing, no-body, no crime.
Yep.
Well, that's not the case anymore. They've been trying no-body cases and been trying them successfully. So I don't think that that's the final impediment. I think it's an impediment if they have somebody who maybe checks a few boxes, but we don't want somebody who's checking a few boxes. We want the fucking actual person that did it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that there's my defense attorney coming out. Like we want to catch the actual perp or perpetrators of this. We don't want somebody that's just somebody that they might be able to cram a square peg into a round hole with, because that's not justice for the Guthrie family. It's certainly not justice for Nancy. So if I think we can all assume, sadly, at this point, that she's no longer with us. So I don't know, man. I tend to think that they probably don't have a real strong lead, you know? Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because there's so many boxes you want to check here, and it's going to be up to the prosecutor in the DA in the case of, okay, this is enough. If they have somebody on their radar before they go and make an arrest or anything like that. If you look at some other cases, sometimes we look at cases and go, well, my God, you've had a lot. It took you this long to arrest the person. Like David, for example, that case, the D4VD. Like we were talking forever. Like this is a cornucopia of incriminating shit. But it took them some time to really get there to be sure that, you know, everything completely checked out before they made that arrest. That's a case that's a little more black and white, if you will, or just more direct. There's so much nuance here. So much we don't know how much is actually part of the case, not part of the case, evidence that's actually there, or just nuance. That's got to make it a lot harder from a prosecutorial standpoint to I guess pull the trigger on somebody, but first you got to have somebody to pull the trigger on.
Totally. And look, we know for a fact that they have thoroughly vetted everyone in the inner circle.
Yep.
What I'm saying, like everyone in that's where they're starting. Now those are going to be their strongest leads. And they're going to do all the work necessary in order to check their alibis, vet them completely, and clear them, you know? Yep. So I feel at this point, based on what we know, which is pretty limited, frankly,
you know,
they've been pretty tight-lipped, you know, we get the occasional little breadcrumb gets dropped for us, but you know, it's really nothing of substance. That I feel like we can feel pretty secure about the fact that it was nobody in the inner circle, and that it was nobody that the inner circle hired, unless they were, you know, excellent at hiding the paper trail. You know, I mean, because it's the paper trail where you're always going to be able to kind of get those murder for hire type things. And then again, you're looking at, you know, what's the motive there, you know, and obviously the motive is usually money. So I mean, it's a perplexing case in the sense that if it was random, you know, they might never get anybody. But why would it have been random? Like, I frankly, I love your theory, like you and Robin's theory that they were.
Gem? Yeah, yeah, there was a neighbor. It's simple.
It's as plausible as anything else I've heard.
It is.
It keeps it simple because you got to match it to what you see and what you know. And when you look at Porch Guy, you're like, this is not a complex operation. And people keep wanting to make it complex because it's because there's so much air to fill the gaps with because no one's saying much, which means they're either doing a really good job of keeping their lips shut or there's really nothing to go on. And circling back, you know, so using our conjecture and saying they'll eventually get someone, I'm really curious about this, Bob. I know Nanos's department is leading the investigation, we think, because that's what they're saying. Do you think this is going to ultimately then be prosecuted at the state level or a federal level? And regardless of that, throw on top of that, they get someone and say they got a lot on him. Say he's got a cell phone on him, and maybe even confesses on that cell phone, does something, gets a lot of digital footprint, you know, best case scenario. How hard is it going to be for either state or federal to prosecute him, given all the missteps that they've had on the on collecting evidence, Nanos' statements, all these things?
I think my inkling would be that it would go federal. I hope that the feds are still involved more than Pima is, just because of competency issues. And if with the kidnapping, you know, you've got the ability to be able to charge federally for sure, based on what we know. You know, obviously, if the investigation is you know, got some issues, I mean, I'm feeling more comfortable putting feds on the stand than I am Pima County on the stand. You know, like from a defense attorney's perspective, if you're like, okay, I'm going to give you a choice of two agencies to choose from to be able to cross-examine and hammer away at their investigation. So I'm going to give you Pima County Sheriff's Department or the FBI. I'm picking Pima County Sheriff's Department all day. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like there's just a cornucopia of things that we could point out that just weren't done properly, at least at this distance. You know what I'm saying? So you would hope that it would go federal, but
who makes that call?
Well, I mean, as you see with Luigi Mangione, they both made the call.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, I mean, right.
It's like,
but that's when they're cooperating, you know. But since it looks like, you know, so say it's what we have the conjecture on the outside is that Pima County and the feds aren't getting along super well and cooperating as well as they might otherwise be. And so say you have a situation where people really aren't talking, they don't want to agree on anyone. Who does it stay with Pima County then if they don't want to release it? Is that, do they have the right to hold it?
I mean, right. It's jurisdiction.
I mean, even if it's federal, though, even if there's federal crimes involved,
I think that Pima can't stop them if there's been federal crimes that have been violated. Then you have a Luigi, like, because I don't know how well the agencies work together in Luigi Mangione. Yeah. You know, like we don't, and we had multiple agencies involved there.
Yeah, and multiple states too.
And that's what I'm saying. Yeah. You know what I mean? So.
At the end of the day here, I mean, they'll call local, they'll call Pima County officers to the stand if we ever get to a trial somewhere. They're going to call Pima, they're going to call feds, they're going to call them both to this. So it's like an and or of who's going to be able to be called to the stand if they're in part of the investigation into this case. So there's a harsh reality here that whoever they find and blame for this, and maybe is the person who does it, whoever they get, you're going to have Nanos on the stand at some point. And you're going to have a defense attorney. I mean, my God, that's a horror story no matter what. With Nanos on the stand.
You might not have Nanos on the stand.
You don't think that the defense would call Nanos on the stand no matter what, just to
what, their own witness, just to like, you can't.
Just because he seems like he'd be an easy one to trip up to get to say shit that's going to point to reasonable doubt.
You can't call your own witness simply to impeach him. It's not allowed. So
well,
like,
it's not the intent. I mean, I think it would just naturally happen.
I mean, it's hard because it's a direct examination. You know what I'm saying? It changes the dynamic of it.
But why wouldn't you call the sheriff up for this if you're prosecuting this case or if you're defending this case? Why? I mean, certainly, I mean, prosecutorial wise, I could see why you wouldn't want to, but. Do you see a world where they wouldn't put Nanos on the stand? Really?
I mean, how often do you
see, the investigator?
Like, think about this. Think about any case that you're dealing with. In a lot of cases that we cover, you have sheriff departments, and it's pretty rare to see the actual elected sheriff to be the one that's testifying. It's going to be the guys that were and gals that were out there doing the work, you know, that were actually conducting the investigation. He's the overseer. You know what I'm saying? That's not to say that there's not some connective tissue to where there's not some relevance to get him on the stand. But, you know, when you're nitpicking in an investigation, you're doing exactly that. And what are you getting from him if it's a situation where you're attacking collection or, you know, things that they didn't do specifically that he had no hand in actually doing himself? You know what I'm saying? So I hear what you're saying. Like he's for the defense. He's a tasty character.
He's a delicious, delicious
character. Yeah. I'd say probably the only thing to call him on is that as I'm going through my mind too, and I completely agree, Bob, you know, they're going to call the investigators, the interviewers, the people actually doing the investigation. He's like their public affairs front man for it, which wouldn't call. Right. Unless, do you see any way they'd call him because he might be in charge of the training that they received when it came to evidence collection or something like that?
If that's the case, then I suppose so. But I don't.
It's a stretch. Yeah, I know. I'm with you. It's a stretch.
He's not training anybody.
But he seems so well trained. He really goes by the book. But
I say that because it's actually the sheriff that actually allocates the funds for training, says what training they should get, and also so here actually as I'm thinking about it live, could they call him and have him testify as to why he removed a certain investigator from a spot? In other words, he had senior people, again, pure conjecture, what we heard on the outside, you know, removing a senior investigator, putting a junior investigator in charge of this. Could he be called to answer to why he had the personnel shifts and changes he had that impacted the investigation?
I mean, who's calling him? Is it the defense? Because remember, I don't want to, in terms of direct examining him, it's a much different beast than being able to cross-examine him. You would go up there as not a friendly witness, and he knows that you're up there not his buddy, right? You're going to be trying to extract information that's not helpful to the prosecution from him. So he would be a combative witness. I don't know that he would rise to the level of, you know, you being able to get the judge to say, okay, well, he's hostile. You know, I want to be able to cross him. Like, I don't know that you'd be able to get there with that. So, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's kind of got the feeling of the way that we were talking about the Moscow police before the Koberger arrest.
Yeah.
You know, and I like think back to that, harken back, like, let's pull up some coverage from the shit talking that was going on about those guys, that they're over their skis. I mean, you had the families screaming at them. Everyone was going at them. Again, we'll find out if there ever is an arrest. I mean, you know, every crime doesn't get solved. That's fact.
No. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, that is just fact.
Do you think, I mean, not that it's up to him if he's going to testify or anything like that, but I mean, just put his ego into to the mix of all of this here. I feel, I mean, my conjecture is this is a guy who's going to be itching to testify for whoever he needs to, just because he wants to be in the public and he likes to spout. I mean, he thinks he's doing the right thing. He thinks he's arguing for his side, but so many times he just puts his foot in his mouth, but then he goes, that was delicious, and doesn't seem to notice while the rest of the world goes, what the hell was that? I mean, I don't know. It'll be very fascinating. I really appreciate kind of like showing the other side of that. Because to me as a layperson, I go, well, why wouldn't he? That does make sense. Why? Maybe he won't. It's something certainly to consider. Let's talk about the notes for a second. Obviously, there's the first two that have been talked about endlessly, initially in IP, saying we want a couple millions in Bitcoin. And then a little bit later, another from the same IP saying she's dead. Sorry, in so many words, not asking for more Bitcoin. And then that kind of ends from that IP. Then you have this conglomerate of emails that TMZ is getting that Harvey's talking about all the time, claiming that, that they didn't do it, but they have information. They know where she is. They have video. They have images on a secret phone that's hidden somewhere. And if you give us one Bitcoin, 60 grand about, depending on the day of the week, then we'll tell you where to find that phone. And that phone's going to tell you everything you need to know. But they're not going to give you any proof that they have any of it whatsoever. These are, I don't believe they're the same people by any stretch of the imagination.
Prince from Algeria.
Yeah, I mean, so let's. There are the two sets. I don't want to converge the two as so many do because it is confusing. But they are not the same. They are not the same IP. There's no one that can clearly say these two are truly connected. There's not anything that points to it. In fact, it points opposite. When you go back to the originals, though, Bob, I mean, it's really isn't much of a legal question, just more of a conjecture, your opinion from watching this question as a human. What's your take? I mean, the idea that a kidnapper asks for the Bitcoin, that seems somewhat realistic, but then she's dead. Sorry, we don't need any money.
Right, yeah.
What the hell is that? I mean, does that tell you right away that first demand came from someone who really didn't have her to begin with? But why send anything? Why even put any other communication into the ether? Every time you cast that line out there, there's some sort of chance you could be found out. Why risk it? Why even say it? Or did they suddenly have a moment of moral clarity, or is it all just bunk?
It smells a lot like, and I'm no profiler. Our brother here, Robin Drake, is going to be far closer to that than I would be. To me, it smells like a mitigation letter. You know, it's like it reads the one where, you know, that she's buried with nature is it really feels like if that and this is under the premise that this person is the person that either actually has knowledge or had a hand in it, right? Like, so if it's just somebody making shit up, then it doesn't mean anything. So, but if this is a person that is involved or was involved and they're kind of laying that out there, they're kind of trying to say, look, things went awry. Like I'm trying to tell you right now, this wasn't our intent. This wasn't my intent. This was not something that was planned. This just happened in order to try to soften the blow if and when this is the person or persons that did something and this person is taken into custody and ultimately charged. Whether or not that's effective, it's bizarre, man.
Does that soften the blow, though?
No.
I mean, at the end of the day, you took her, she died in your custody. Does that matter one iota to a judge, whether it's murder one, murder two, manslaughter, whatever the hell they charge? Does the fact but judge, I said it was an accident that she died. That kid doesn't hold any water, right?
I mean, if you put it out there early enough, the defense is certainly going to argue it. The question is whether or not a jury's going to buy it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, because you see it all the time. Like they're always using context clues from all of our social media and our messengers and our text messages, you know, and they're building cases on stuff like that, wherein they're trying to prove intent from what people typed in a text message or said in Messenger. You know what I'm saying? So, mm-hmm. I mean, the defense would argue it. Like they'd say, look, they put it out there early that this wasn't intentional, that the intent wasn't to kill Nancy Guthrie, but ultimately something else happened. And then again, the problem is going to be, have they recovered the body? And yeah. once they have recovered the body, is there anything that they could do forensically to determine the cause of death?
Yeah.
You know, so like that's the thing. Like, if you have a situation, say you have a situation like your jewel thief gone horribly wrong,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they get made in there, and Nancy's about to scream, so they cover her mouth, and they're like, what do we do? And we're like, oh my god, let's just bring her with us. And then they have her with her, and they're like, okay, we're just gonna let her out at McDonald's or whatever, and she dies, you know, of a heart attack.
Yeah.
Like, well, like in the middle of the thing, and they're like, oh my god, like what do we do? You know what I mean? Like what do we do? And so, because like, who are they talking to?
Yeah.
Like, I had a client that called me up and said, all right, I am actually still in the process of committing this crime. You know, like it was something that went terribly wrong. But at this point, for all intents and purposes, I still have Nancy Guthrie kidnapped. However, here's the thing. She's dead, but we still have her with us. You know what I mean? Like, as an attorney, I think ethically I'd be obligated, because it's an ongoing crime, that I'd have to report it.
Yeah.
You know, which is a strange thing. I mean, if I am made aware by my client of a future crime, the privilege does not supersede that.
Sure.
Like,
sure.
If I know that somebody is going to be committing a crime in the future and they've told me when they're going to do it, being a lawyer doesn't mean that you don't alert law enforcement, because you do. Like, so that's like, you know, things that we're talking about for privilege are things that have happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So like future stuff. So, but I mean, man, it's a weird situation though, isn't it? It's like, yeah. you know, I don't know.
If like, it's weird. So
like
things that are weird don't fit to me.
This is something that has been rattling around in my brain. In terms of the notes, because nothing's come of them, right?
Yeah.
Like nothing is, like they make these ransoms, but then they don't show up for the dough when people, yeah. you know, it's like, when you kind of look at it, if you're in Tony and Robin especially, like if you're looking at this thing and you're like, all right, if you're going to send this thing out and it's not real, who is benefiting the most from doing that? Like currently, like out of anybody in the world or multiple people in the world, who is profiting the most from sending a bogus ransom?
Well, who's ever talking about it, really? So, I mean, if you're the one that's getting the notes, that would be TMZ.
I mean, you know, there's yeah. like on a different level. I mean, YouTube has had a lot of coverage too.
Yeah, I mean, because then we all talk about it.
I'm looking into all of them.
Yeah, but if the source where the notes are going to TMZ, I mean, yeah, I mean, they're gonna run with it. I mean, it's almost like here's a silver platter of content, like. You know, either you can pretend it's not real, or maybe it isn't real, or you can play it up like it's something, and everyone's going to click on it regardless.
Crazy to me. I'm thinking more like content creators, like you know what I'm saying? Because like TMZ, I'm just saying it's a theory.
Like maybe it's a rogue content creator that is sending these out so it creates more to talk about on the case. I mean, it's not a crazy idea, Bob, at all.
It's not a crazy idea.
No.
I don't know. You know, I mean, and who, like if you're a content creator, you're not going to take the risk of sending it to TMs or to the feds. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to send it to law enforcement. Like to me, when that first started happening, I'm like, all right, because I'm always thinking of like if it's not real,
mm-hmm.
who's benefiting from it?
Everyone that's promoting it.
True.
I don't know.
There has been more notes. there have been other notes that content creators have gotten that they've never publicized. I know that. I know TMZ has obviously run to the air with all of them, but I know there's others who have, we have not received anything here, but I know other people who have actually received or basically fake ransom letters, or maybe they're real. We don't know what they are, but they're ransom letters. But again, there's so much fishing going on right now, I think, in this, for anybody that will run with it. And somebody out there, I'm guessing, is hoping, a fake person is out there hoping, you know, one of these creators is going to pay me a Bitcoin for their content.
And just making a shit ton of money off this case.
Yeah, that's an interesting angle.
So if you remove one thing, the reason why at the very beginning I was not on board with these letters at all was because it doesn't fit what kidnappers do. It just doesn't, the way they were handled, the way they're delivered, all that. It's a one-off. It's never been done this way before. If you're going to do a kidnapping for profit, nothing fits, except the one thing that got people believing it was they said there's specific information that's not been shared with the public that said they had inside knowledge of the house. So we have to take it on the word of the family and Harvey Levin that there is specific information that AI couldn't generate that made this believable. If you remove that one fact that no one knows what the data in that actually is, no one even be paying attention to these letters because they wouldn't be saying they're all spam fishers because it doesn't fit any behavior pattern that anyone has ever been done before. That's why I'm highly skeptical of all the letters from the very beginning, because it just does not fit what people would do. And then let's do our thought experiment again on, all right, so let's assume that the letters are right, or you want to assume the letters are right. You look at Porch Guy. You look at how he dressed. You look at the amount of money he spent and didn't spend on his outfit. Walmart, the lack of covertness of it. Although he covered himself really well, it was just it just didn't ring as a true professional, someone with a few reps. So I love Bob's analogy of what probably happened from his context. You know, he goes in there, they go in there because they knew a jewelry thing's in town and they thought there was going to be jewelry, no jewelry. They looked around for 41 minutes, couldn't find any. She wakes up, they say, oh my God, we got to take her, panic escalation. Low percentiles for that, but they do happen. They remove her and then they're going to dump her off at a McDonald's and she dies along the way. The last thing you're going to do then is, oh my God, I'm sorry. If you're so stupid that you have to actually rob someone and take their money because you can't provide a living for yourself another way, the last thing you're thinking of is doing something like that. You're running. You're not communicating. You're dumping bodies and running. That's why, again, every single letter that's come out, if it hadn't been for the one detail that people are saying, a few people that only have knowledge that these things have specific things that only they could do, know about, and not AI, even though I'm a believer of this one degree of separation, someone knows that house, knows what was inside, knows where Nancy was at. So
what do we know what those things that only the kidnapper would
only
know?
Conjecture I've heard is that they knew where what she was wearing and where she placed her Apple Watch.
Where is that?
Again, I haven't sourced it. And that's why I'm so skeptical of it, because if you actually pump into AI, you know, what's an 84-year-old woman typically wear to bed if she uses this kind of lifestyle? If she wears an Apple Watch and if they have photos of the house that have been collected over, you know, the last 10 or 20 years from Savannah being in and out and doing things like that, there's a lot of conjecture AI can put together to kind of give you a close enough to do this. I did it with my own family and I was like, wow, that's some scary shit. So I'm highly skeptical.
Pictures of Nancy Guthrie are out in the public sphere in terms of like shit that her daughters have posted, her kids have posted, like on Facebook. I mean,
they did specials with her on the Today Show.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there exist any photographs in the public sphere that
it does.
There's an Apple Watch. I don't know, man. She was wearing pajamas. She was wearing a nice flowered set of pajamas.
Exactly. Without knowing the exact verbiage, it's hard to say what weight is on it. Right. You know, if it's like, well, the watch was in a case and the case looked like this and it was on the nightstand. Like, even then, you could still even someone go, well, I saw her on Today's Show and they were in the bedroom and one could make some wild guesses here. I don't know. It's not solid. I'm not saying it's not solid, but there's not enough info in the ether for us lay people to really be able to say, right, yes or no.
That's why I'm still living in the world of maybe on this one.
So much maybe.
Yeah, maybe. It's weird. I mean, look, But the things that we're talking about, I guarantee you, this is it's all the stuff they're looking into.
Yeah.
You know, because like the first thing they have to figure out is whether or not the ransom notes are legit. Now, if they do contain things, like to me, it would have to go beyond, you know, like everybody charges their Apple Watch on their, yeah, their nightstand, you know, and it's like my thing's like right here. I've got my
From what I understand, I believe, and I could be off on this again, because there's so much damn reporting on this. And this is what I heard yesterday when I was on with Nancy Grace. Maureen O'Connell was on with me, and she's the one last week who retired FBI who made the statement last week that she was 75% sure that they were on the right track, that there's probably an arrest coming soon, essentially. She said that to Megyn Kelly and made a big story. When we were talking yesterday about this, she had mentioned, if my memory serves me correct, I apologize if it's not, but I'm pretty sure she said this yesterday with on the show, that the watch was on the ground. I've heard other people say that too. Again, not, I mean, it's not that specific. It's on the ground. You're charging the watch there. It may be falling on the ground. It's not a crazy thought to think that if there's a struggle getting somebody out of the room, that maybe the Apple Watch fell on the ground. I don't know.
I mean, man.
Yeah, like, I need more than that.
God, that none of that feels like it, is somebody claiming that that was what was in one of the ransom notes, that the Apple Watch was?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that I don't know.
Like, it's it's more specific than just there's an Apple Watch she left behind. But is it as specific as it appears to be? I mean, on the ground,
which is fine, because all right, so then we assume, so if you wanted to say that those, like they said, the first two are the legit ones because it came from them, it shows that the intent was not to kidnap, and the intent was to go in there and get something else. Because again, if the intent was to get money, there's ways to get money. But they're not doing it.
Could this be a complete one-off, Robin, too? I mean, because we're talking about, like, statistically what people do if they're going to kidnap. If this person's never kidnapped a person in their life, had no intention of kidnapping a person in their life, and this shit all went wrong and she dies in their custody, is it a crazy far stretch to think that maybe if they're an empathetic person that they would send a note saying, we're sorry, she's dead? If that is just, you know, they just don't know what the hell to do. They don't know how to play this game. They've never played this game before. They were intending to play the game.
So that makes a lot of sense, because it's not fitting any pattern of kidnappings we've ever seen before. Yeah. It shows this person has not done this before.
Yeah.
And like you said, and granted, I'm on board with the fact that the BAUs weighed in with Savannah to make that second statement that the family put out, because it's an extremely empathetic statement, which would correspond with the second letter being very empathetic, because you want to do matching, right? Mm-hmm. Emotional matching. It's a powerful tool to compel someone, to inspire someone to take an action. And which would make sense, again, if the intent was not to take her, it was a byproduct of something botched that they did wrong. That makes a lot of sense to me compared to anything else.
Yeah. Like, no one keeps an Apple Watch in a case. I don't even know what that means. I've been wearing an Apple Watch for 5 years.
Oh, not in a case. No, it was on the ground.
Okay. Well, yeah. Oh, wait, what? So wait, Lynn.
Oh, somebody saying a case?
I fell on the ground.
Like, I haven't heard that. I don't know anything about a case.
I don't know what that is.
No.
I like, if it's me, if I'm law enforcement, I need something like, okay, you know, if the ransom note said, okay, well, they're on the kitchen table, there was a New York Times crossword puzzle from Tuesday that was half completed. Like that is something. And if that was a fact, then I know that somebody was in that house saying some shit like the Apple Watch was on the floor. I mean, like, unless it's accurate. I mean, I guess if it's accurate,
it could be. Yeah, and that's, we just don't know.
There's one more thing on the FBI's BAU being involved in responding to those, you know, working with Savannah to respond empathetically. Just because they crafted a response doesn't mean they thought it was legit.
True.
They could have been very 50-50 on this. Again, we don't know because we haven't heard from them. We'll never hear from them. But I mean, I would do that because if you're going, remember, we said it yesterday on the show. I say it all the time. In the world that I lived in, all intelligence is good intelligence, even if it rules something out. And so if you took an action because you believed it to be legit and you put an empathetic statement out there that should garner a response you're looking for, if it doesn't garner the response you're looking for, that's intelligence you can now move on, because now it's saying that this might not be as legit as we thought it was because we didn't get the response we should have gotten from this empathetic statement that Savannah put out.
Yeah,
that's, you got nothing to lose. To something else.
Nothing to lose. Yeah, I mean,
if you guys are, if we're going with the bungling, you know, the bungling jewel thief theory, and you know, and she passes away for natural causes because of the stress.
She's 84.
Right. I mean, it's like she's horrified, right? I mean, you're in the desert, man.
Yeah.
You know, like to me, this thing, like I don't know, is Othram handling the.
Yeah.
Are they handling, like, you know, and like everybody that knows me knows I'm a huge fan of that lab. And, you know, if they're going to be able to pull a profile off of it, then if anybody is, it's going to be them. To me, I just don't think this is going to be a case that's going to get solved through forensic evidence. I think it's going to be somebody's going to talk.
Yeah,
you know, like I get that's where I'm at with this thing, because the one thing that I know for certain is that there had to have been more than one person involved. I think that if you're going in on a jewel heist, mm-hmm. I mean, is that to say that there don't exist like individual guys that go in and you know, are jewel thieves? I'm sure there are. I think most of the times you're going to have a couple of guys. You know, you're going to have a little bit of a crew because of the unknowns. You know, it's like, and if you've got multiple people involved, and if you have somebody who had to go out to the desert somewhere and you know, bury Nancy's body somewhere out in the desert where no one's ever going to find it, you know, the odds are that at some point somebody knows something, and the question then becomes, when is that person going to talk?
You know, time will tell.
Yeah, bungling jewelers typically one, two tops, and typically it's person that's very close to the first person, so there's no compromise on that. So it's kind of 50-50 on whether they speak or not after a period of time.
Yeah. Time will tell. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. The links are in the description. Let's go over to another topic that we're covering. Alec Murdaugh walked into a Lexington County courtroom in double shackles and an orange jumpsuit, his first appearance since the Supreme Court threw out his murder convictions. What happened over the next hour told you everything about how the defense is preparing for the April 5th of 2027 trial. Mark your calendars now. Take off from work, get the kids out of school, and get some popcorn. 8 new expert witnesses, first responder transcripts suggesting other people were at Moselle that night, a demand for DNA testing using the same lab that cracked the Koberger case, and a fight over whether the defendant gets to look like a human being in front of the cameras. Bob Mata's with myself and Robin Drake as we break down all of this. Right now, it's a lot of procedural motions. They're trying to plan this, and as we all know, most cases, so much of it takes place before the actual trial in terms of where this thing is going. One of the things that they're asking for Alec is to have a laptop in prison. Not a crazy ask. I mean, he's got to be part of his defense as well. No other inmate gets one, but there's a lot of paper. There's boxes and boxes and boxes of paperwork, as it's been argued. The judge said no. But she did offer a conference room instead. Harpudlin said without digital access to discovery, he'd need a year. Is this a fair compromise there, Bob? Is it okay that he doesn't have a computer, or are we already seeing them, you know, really tightening the noose around Alec in his own participation of his defense?
I mean, it's a tough call.
Yeah,
I the defendant should have access to the discovery in his case. It's not unusual for defendants not to be left with discovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I think that he should be given access maybe for certain periods of time where he has access to a laptop that has, you know, the flash drives or the hard drives, the external hard drives connected to it so that he can comb through it for a bit? I think that he should. Do I think that he should be able to have a laptop in his computer 24/7? No.
Yeah. You know,
I don't think that there's going to be a judge on the planet that would allow a defendant that kind of access.
He's still convicted of the other crimes.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But different crimes.
Right. Different
crimes. But he's still in jail for it. So he's still a prisoner.
All
right.
So, do I think that there's a potential Sixth Amendment type issue? Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with it, it's like does it hurt anything if he plays a little minesweeper on the side to prevent a chance of another appeal or another successful appeal? You want to make sure everything is just reduce the odds of this. We don't want to talk about Alec Murdaugh for the next 20 years. Another thing that was brought up, Harpootalan brought up the first responder transcripts. This is kind of interesting. To the court, he told the judge other people were at Moselle that night whose accounts don't match. Okay. I mean, it's lawyer speak. You know, it sounds big. It sounds exciting. It sounds interesting. Maybe there's something to it. How far can the defense go with that without naming an alternative suspect if they're going to go down that road? How specific do they need to get? Do they need to get all the way like Karen Reed style, where they're saying there are these people in the house that did these things, but we're not going to really get into super great detail other than they might have had something? Can it be to that vague of level? How specific does the defense need to go in the Murdaugh case? How far can they go without getting more specific?
If you can connect the person to the crime, and usually if you can place a person within the proximity, mm-hmm. you're cooking with gas at that point. You know, it's a different thing. Like with the Reed thing, you know, that wasn't just some random people. That was people where this guy was supposed to be heading, and there was
proof. Sure.
Yeah. You know, they found him on the lawn. Like mm-hmm. that, like that is, you know, and in that case, Canone, she allowed the third party culprit to come in through Bowden, which is mm-hmm. a Massachusetts case talking about, you know, the lack of an investigation or the poor investigation ultimately. But here you kind of have some of those same problems with Sled's investigation.
Yes.
We talked about it a bit last week.
Yeah.
And you know, if you can put people in that area, like you said, there's got to be some connective tissue. You just can't pick random people, you know, out of thin air and be like, that guy seems like a guy who, you know, it's got to be more than that. And if you can put somebody at or around a crime scene at the time that it took place, at that point, you've got something going. Whether or not it's going to be admissible, we still might need more, but at least you're there. Because if you can't place anybody specifically within that area, it's dead mm-hmm. in the water. Like, you have to at least have that kind of connective tissue.
So all they have to do is show, because that's my question, Bob, because again, I don't know this side of it that well. So all they have to do, they don't have to actually say name someone or even a position or a job title of someone. They just have to say other people around there to deflect off of him as a possible third party, and that's what that can be a defense, or they actually have to name. So in other words, reverse fishing expedition?
You can't just say other people. Like, they don't necessarily have to hand over the killer, right? Like, that is not something that you have to do. But I mean, like, the case that we're all, you know, relatively passionate about, I'm exceptionally passionate about, Tony's pretty passionate about, you know, Richard Allen.
Yeah, me too.
You know, we've got a guy with the initials EF that puts himself at the crime scene, that says that he left DNA at the crime scene, that seemed to know something about the placement of sticks around the body, and Gull didn't let the defense bring him in, you know, but Gull was not a good judge. You know what I'm saying? Like, and in that particular situation, you had the names,
right?
You know, and whether or not you believed their alibis, which I don't, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't think that they were properly vetted. I don't think that they did the work that they needed to do. So, I mean, you can't just say it was some random. You're going to have to give some kind of detail.
Yeah.
Like, it can't be so wide open in terms of the defense throwing a third party culprit. You've got to give something for the jury to hang their hat on. It can't just be, well, you know, I mean, if you have enough to say, all right, look, we had two samples that we pulled, okay, from the crime scene. You know, one was based on DNA that we found on Maggie, and we haven't been able to get a match of the profile, but we have been able to match it with all the known profiles. So we know that it was nobody in the family. We know that it was nobody in law enforcement that was there at the scene. So we've been able to eliminate all the people that it's not. based on people that we know that were at the scene. I mean, like, it'll be a highly litigated issue.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Could they, but part of that thing, could they then tie it to, you know, one of the things that we've been throwing around as a loose possibility is, all right, drug cartel hit to get retribution, and the guy, we can't find him because this hit guy fled back across the border. Is that loose enough, or tight enough, and actually to deflect that way and say that's a third party type of culprit?
I mean, I don't know, but I don't think so. But I think what you're looking at probably is more likely than not, if you've got unknown profiles that have been pulled from the scene, and they're not able to come up with a name because they're not in COVID, not able to do it. You know, you're pointing to the fact that there is unknown profiles that exist.
You could point an unsub.
Right. You know, and I mean, you're certainly allowed to do that and say, look, you know, then you're dealing with the thing that we were talking about on last week's episode, wherein we're saying, okay, it doesn't appear that Maggie had any kind of defensive wounds. This doesn't appear to have been a struggle. You know, like this is a homicide that took place from a distance. So at what point would anybody have had the opportunity to have, you know, Maggie scratch them to where she's getting DNA under her fingernail? Right. You know, so it's like you're having to deal with that if you're the defense, in terms of, because I think the prosecution has a pretty damn strong argument that whatever it was is completely innocent. She was getting a mani and pedicure, and you know, it was from the nail tech or whatever the case may be. You could pick up DNA anywhere. You know what I'm saying? So
when you unpack this case again and we look at all the evidence, and yes, there was really bad parts of this investigation, without a doubt. And you need reasonable doubt here. But any way you look at it, it looks pretty ick for Alec Murdaugh. Like the timing, I know they're going to try and argue. They're going to try, like, see, the timing was off originally, and there was more time between this. I don't know how they're going to do it, but they're going to find a way. So all these little things that still look pretty ick towards him. Like, yeah, but it still pretty much looks like there's nobody else that, or at the very least, you were there and you know something, whether you did it or not. Is this a case that for Alec Murdaugh, it's not going to be one going down those lanes? Is this a case that could be one for Alec Murdaugh by getting more of his family up there and showing just how far of a deviation this would be from his character to do something like this and really try to sell the jury on that? And I got to ask, how difficult is that going to be round two? Everybody in round one, we're pretty sympathetic figures to Alec Murdaugh, the family that went up there and testified about what a loving father he was, blah, 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 blah. You know, I don't, they may have a little different opinions this time around, knowing how vile Alec actually is, to get the real convincing rah, rah, he's a family man. Do you rely more on that than you do a third party or timing or slight inconsistencies or trying to poke holes in a shitty investigation?
I think that I think if you're the defense in this particular trial, you are attacking their entire timeline and all their forensic evidence. Like they did it to some extent, you know, but we had the bizarre, you know, two little gray men video. Like their shit was not good.
Yeah.
Like the defense that they put on in terms of countering the state's forensic evidence, and especially digital evidence, was not good. You know, I think that they're going to spend a lot more time and money in terms of attacking that evidence, because essentially, remember, Murdaugh was one of the first cases, if not the first case that I'm aware of, at least, wherein they basically established a time of death based on usage of cell phone and when that stopped. Like, I mean, that is when they determined that Maggie died. You know, based on when, and Paul for that matter. So, you know, they're going to have to really kind of like dig into that particular evidence through expert testimony and put on a convincing case, because, you know, I don't know what the inner workings are with Buster and his father. You know, I don't know, you know, because I think that there's an argument to be made if you're of the mindset that, you know, which I've always been of the mindset that Murdaugh, throughout the course of his life as a family man, deeply loved his family.
Yeah.
You know, which has always been my biggest hurdle in terms of him being the actual one to pull the triggers.
Me too.
You know, it's just always been my thing. And I don't give a shit if people are going to lose their minds in chat. I don't care. You're not changing my mind. And, you know, there is that concept. Was his drug use so prevalent that his mind was scrambled and he wasn't thinking clearly at all at any point? And that just drove him to do this unthinkable thing, where in any other situation, it never would be something he'd be capable of. Maybe. I certainly can't say it's not, because it certainly exists in the world that Alec did it. Right. Sure. You know what I'm saying? My thing has always been, if he came up with this crazy, you know, if the state's motive matches to what actually happened in terms of he's trying to, you know, squirrel, look over here, look at all this, look at this trauma I'm going through. How can you be coming after me when I'm going through all this shit right over here? You know, and he's trying to stall, you know, the impending storm. what does Creighton call it? The gathering storm.
The gathering storm of the family annihilator.
It's going to be fascinating to see where they go with this in terms of the defense. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Let's move over to the prosecution of this case. They told the judge that they're ready to try Alec Murdaugh before the end of 2026. The judge gave them till April. That's 10 months to rebuild a case that just lost its most powerful narrative. The 12 and a half hours of financial crimes testimony, the Supreme Court said, went too far. Now, they didn't say you can't talk about it, but they said, watch it. Watch your step a little bit there, buddy. Now, everybody looks at that and go, oh, my gosh, that was the most damning part of this. I don't know if it was. I mean, it was damning. It was certainly a very strong part of this case. But what about the boat crash? What about the activity that he did in that whole scene of trying to intimidate witnesses, it appeared, or get people to tell a certain story, certain ways? We saw some of that come up in round one. None of that has been brought to light. That could, I think, taint Alec in front of a jury pretty good as well. But again, different case, but somewhat connected here. How much of that do you think can get in round two to taint the character of Alec Murdaugh, Bob?
I mean, it's going to be substantially less.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I don't think that's a death knell. I don't think that there's anyone that watched that trial from beginning to end that didn't think it was too much of the financial crime shit that came in at trial. It was too much. He didn't need that much. And some version of the financial crimes is always coming in because it goes to the state's theory of motive.
Yeah.
Right. So it's always going to come in. I mean, that was kind of the brilliance of the way Creighton, decided upon landing on that particular motive, because he knew that was going to be allowing him to get in these financial crimes that you know, lay him out as the shitbag that he is. And I'm talking about Murdaugh.
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise, if you're not putting that forward as your motive, I don't know that it's relevant to come in a murder case. You know what I'm saying? So that was kind of the ingenious move by Waters to get that stuff in. And I think if you trim all the fat off of it and you're still getting it in, it might be more effective in terms of, because sometimes in the law, less is more. And I think that this might be one of those situations where they're going to get enough in to where they get the vibe that, look, Alex, he had a motive for creating sympathy and to buy himself time, because he was going to try to make all this shit right in terms of the missing money and the IOLTA, the lawyer trust account, all that stuff. All he needed was a little bit of time.
Yeah.
I just needed to divert everybody's attention to this horrible thing that happened on my property. And I didn't do it, but I got to.
I don't know, Judge. Go over here. Look at this. That's all it is.
Yeah. So can they still admit? Because I thought it was really the big link for me. One of them, besides all the financial stuff, obviously, as the main thing, but his attempt to shoot himself or hire someone to shoot him prior to this to garner that sympathy as well, I thought really laid out that this was just another example of that. Is that something that can come in?
Oh, I think so. I think
that's a strong one because again, when we're showing arcs of behavior, is it like that's my question always. Can you convict someone of being a shitbag? Because he is, and I think that's what all those things are showing. But this actually, that to me is a real data point on something he's done in the past to sway sympathy in his favor, and this is just another act of that.
I mean, look, it's going to get, that aspect of it is going to be litigated again in motion in limine. I mean, the defense is certainly going to try to keep it out.
Right.
As not being relevant to the actual shootings and homicides. And we got a new judge. So it's going to depend on the way that she views it.
So, boy, you know, I just, on that, it's interesting because I know the three of us have been talking about, you know, his arc in life behavior, especially as the testimony and our conversations with his housekeeper have shown that he never did anything for himself. He always hired someone, which is this third party thing that came in. But I'll tell you, we do have one data point where it actually might be him, and that is that attempt that he did. He hired someone to do it that didn't do it. And so what did he do? When the hired person didn't, he took it on himself to do it and then bungled it.
But you know what he did do?
He hunted a lot. I mean,
right. Yeah, he did. They were a big hunting family.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that all kind of goes to Cousin Eddie's credibility, though, too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, that was a fascinating part of this trial. Like, the whole Cousin Eddie thing was something that, like, I was just absolutely fascinated by every aspect of that in terms of trying to figure it out. But it, again, in terms of relevance, that's your battle if you're the prosecution, and you're going to have to fight the battle again in terms of how is that relevant? Because again, you cannot put prior bad acts in to show propensity. You know what
I
mean?
So you can't use passes prologue. I mean, as a method of garnering sympathy,
motive, opportunity. There, you can use prior bad acts for different things, but you can't use it for propensity. Like, you know what I mean? That, like, this guy, this is the kind of shit that this guy does. You know what I mean? Like, you can't use it like that.
I always have a hard time understanding that line between you can use it and can't use it because it is part of that. All right, that's always challenging.
Well, look at it like this, Robin, with like prior bad acts, and a lot of it's uncharged. It's always our biggest battle in any trial when they're trying to, because we know what they're trying to do. They're really trying to just shit all over the character of the defendant in order to get the jury to convict them. You know, so there's always that argument. And, you know, as the law is developed about allowing prior bad acts to come in over time, I mean, ultimately the courts have said, look, you can't use it to show that it's their, you know, it's within their character, that they have a propensity of, you know, committing those types of crimes. So if they did it before, they've clearly done it again. You know what I mean? So it's
can't
like
show that.
Propensity, no.
Yeah, because I was even thinking that, you know, when cases, you know, go to the horrendous human, not even human being, the bag of genetic goo, Stephen Stearns. You know, so if they had shown, you know, in Maddie Soto's case.
That's different.
But if you have an arc of behavior where you're doing horrendous things to children, that's not relevant to the fact that you're charging someone?
That's different. Like,
how?
Because they just view sex crimes differently. It's a different thing. Like it's a jurisdiction by jurisdiction thing, because like the predilection of being a predator, it just falls in a different category.
So the predilection of just being a self-inflicted stupid idiot isn't
right. It's just not
the death penalty. I want to talk about that. Wilson put the death penalty on the table, at least in some sound bites he has. Now, the original trial obviously didn't seek it. Harpootling called it a campaign sound bite. And in South Carolina, if you're following any of the political things going on there, it's pretty much a battle of who's going to attempt to put Alec Murdaugh to death. is like what some people are going to start running on here. As far as if they can actually get there and it's not showing that it's a prejudice going in, I mean, number one, Bob, what are the odds of it truly being on the table? And when do they need to decide here? We're 10 months out from an Alec Murdaugh trial. When do they need to officially say, yeah, we're seeking the death penalty or we're not? Because obviously cases get handled quite differently. Decisions, motions in limine, everything gets decided very differently if this is a capital case, if this is a non-capital case. I would imagine that it can't be too far down the line.
No, it's got to be in the very near future.
Yeah.
Like, because everything is different. Like the case won't be tried in April. If it becomes a death penalty case, everything changes because there is a lot of moving parts in a death penalty case that don't exist in just a regular, you know, life without the possibility of parole case because, you know, they're trying to execute him. So, yeah, I would admit, I don't think it's happening.
Is it in Alec's interest to have it be a death penalty case? Because that would essentially eliminate or put much tighter restrictions, I should say, on what gets in and what gets out. Anything that's kind of in that gray area, a lot more odds for Alec's favor that it never makes it to trial. And the less of that makes it into trial, the more reasonable doubt he has. You're playing, you know, with a hand with much higher stakes. But at the end of the day, could it be an easier game for him to win if that was, in fact, what's on the table?
Yeah. I mean, in theory, yes.
Do you want to pull that slot machine and hope for the best?
Right. And, you know, from my perspective, I mean, I have to admit, I agree with Poot. You know, I think that it was done for a specific purpose, that it was done to taint the jury pool, you know, because it's effective.
Right.
You know, like if you go out there and you're making a statement that, well, you know, this shit's so serious, we're going to seek the death penalty this time. You know, I mean, it resonates with potential jurors. It just does, you know.
And don't they need to have some new evidence of some sort, something, you know, big from the state's part that they would change what they're seeking? I mean, or can it just be as simple as, well, you know what? We had a moratorium on it back then. We don't anymore. And if we didn't have it back then, we would have chosen it. But it's back, so we're gonna pursue it this round. Is it that simple, or do they need to get more on the table before they can truly put it up there? And how much of an issue could that be in an appeal?
No, I think that it's a choice. You know what I mean? As long as it's on the table, you know, the bigger problem is going to be is that they didn't try to go after the death penalty in the first trial.
Yeah.
That's going to be the bigger issue for them, and especially if he's convicted. And, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, like, that'll be what's litigated. The job will shift from trying to get him a new trial to trying to save his life. Yeah. And that will be the issue that is litigated at the appellate court level. And, you know, like, I don't want to try to guess, but I think it'll be a pretty strong issue in terms of them, you know, probably potentially prevailing on that aspect of it. And I'm talking about Murdaugh's attorneys. Yeah.
And are they are the attorneys death penalty certified too? Because does that matter in South Carolina like it did in Idaho?
I don't know I would have to imagine that Putin and Griffin are.
Yeah.
They're pretty experienced lawyers. Right. Because like death penalty certified just typically means that you've tried a bunch of cases, and in particular, murder cases. So, and those guys are both very long on the tooth. So,
right. And it's not a public defender where they got to make sure it's a public defender that's death penalty certified. These are his choice attorneys, if you will. So, it'll be fascinating. It'll be very fascinating as all this continues to play out. Give us your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We will continue our conversations right there. All right. I'm taking the next about week and a half off. I'm getting married.
We're all going.
So the live episodes will be resuming. Robin's going to be picking up on the 9th. But just so you know, everybody, go enjoy your 4th of July weekend. We're going to be doing some best of the year so far. A look back at 2026 so far for the next week or so, and a lot of our content. And then on the 9th, Robin is back here on the air. And then I will be
holding the ship down the best I can.
On the 14th, I'll be returning. So, everybody enjoy a couple of weeks of summer. I'm going to go get that marriage thing out of the way.
Oh, yeah. And then,
and then I'll return.
Because traveling on July 4th for a wedding on July 4th is a fantastic idea.
Yes. Well, and the location we're doing it at has, it's right next to the area in our city that is putting on a massive fireworks show at like a big outdoor, it's the Walmart Amp in Rogers, Arkansas. We're right next to it at a restaurant, and we got a beautiful place to watch it. So there we are. We're going to enjoy the fireworks that evening and have a great night. And it'll be a great night with our whole crew here. So I'm really excited about that. I'm excited to take a little break, a little breather from all this. But we'll be back in full force here in just a week or two.
You have earned it, my friend.
Yeah,
you
no kidding.
Thank you.
Content king.
Yeah. No. I'm going, and the people are asking, where are you going? What are you going to Mackinac Island up in Michigan is the area where we're going to be at. So,
send anyone to see the movie Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeve. Yep. That's where he's going. I think that's so cool.
It's gorgeous up there.
And I'm going to be dressed as Christopher Reeve, and she's going to be dressed as Jane Seymour, circa Dr. Quinn Medicine era.
Pre-horse accident, Christopher Reeve.
Yes. Yes. Walking Christopher Reeve.
Pre-horse accident. Yes. Superman, I'm not going to be like just kind of going around the aisle. You know, wouldn't that be interesting? But yeah, be difficult. You know, there are no cars on the island. So I guess it'd be another way to get around.
Indeed. Your wife will be saying, man, I didn't sign up for this shit, bro.
I know we were going to the island. I didn't think you were going to be that authentic about it. yeah. Anyway, all right. That's going to wrap it up. That's it. I'm done for a week or two. All right, everybody, crazy, huh? Have a great holiday, a great 4th of July, and I'll see you back here in just a little bit. Of course, we have more content coming out for you all throughout the weeks. It's just our lives will be off for about a week or so. So we'll see you back here when we get back. Until next time, for Bob, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something, but I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public would be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too. Because where you get your information matters.